China de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, de Nijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a una atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundacion Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
You can't kill the metal. Metal will live on. Punk rock tried to kill the metal.
Six months six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airways from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Ha ha.
Michael Marie.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. Fuck the apathetic bullshitters, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
If I could have some peace of mind to tell you what is in
control.
Yeah. You're not gonna be enough to go for the
day.
Supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. I wonder, do you feel all right?
Yeah.
I said, do you feel all right?
Yeah.
All right, at this time, we are happy to present a man now who knows his lesson. Evan Ross Abernathy.
And all we've got to do is to keep marching. Do tomorrow what we did today. And do it the next day. And then the next day, we won't have to do it at all. Because yesterday we filled, day before yesterday we filled up the jails. And then today we filled up the jail yard. And on tomorrow, when they look up and see that number coming, I don't know what they're going to do.
long-haired preachers come out every night.
And welcome to the March 3rd, 2022 edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. This is the short show. We're going to be covering a lot of brief conversations with, some not so brief, but conversations at the Food Not Bombs town clock meal, which there's been some rumors the city authorities are scheming new ways to get rid of. I haven't got a lot of firm data on that yet, but you'll hear a little chat about that. And, well, just listen in and you'll hear what you'll hear.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's kick things off with a little check-in on Food Not Bombs' co-founder and very active volunteer, Keith McHenry, who, well, I caught him in a phone conversation a couple of days ago. I think it was either Monday or Tuesday. And, well, here, it kind of speaks for itself. Line with Captain Jammer Keith McHenry, who's simultaneously doing peace vigils and food vigils and dealing with pressure from the city and threats against the benchlands. What else you got going, Keith?
Oh, that's enough. You know, I'm working on my doing the final edits of my book, things like that. Trying to get people out of prison that shouldn't be in prison. Things like that. Yeah, just a host of helping people find food in other cities and countries.
What do you...
Mailing things, T-shirts and books to people, starting groups and other...
Dig it.
Movies.
What about the local scene? Because I know you mentioned in an email today you have some concerns. Some of these concerns you said you wanted to wait until they were more fully fleshed out, but some you said could be discussed in more length. What do you got for us local?
Okay, well, what it seems like, I don't, you know, I'm waiting for flyers from Micah for the, there's a event coming up that on Saturday, so we're working on that. Where, then we got today's event at, 4 o'clock at the town clock that's, against the war.
That's Tuesday, March 1st.
13th of March. To celebrate 2 years of us being out there every single day serving free food. So, it doesn't seem like that there's a bunch of efforts to close the bench lands and to close Food Not Bombs. And I just saw they're building another condominium. I think they're going to, next to the church, that parking lot finally is going to be, according to their signs.
Which church?
Next to the Calvary Episcopal, that parking lot.
The Red Church, okay.
Yeah, so supposedly that's going to become a 65-unit market rate.
What is this event on Saturday that you mentioned coming up that you're waiting for the flyers for?
On Saturday.
You said you're waiting
There's just like there's an effort to shut down the benchlands. So, you know, there's like some kind of fancy upscale group that's holding some kind of meeting to try to build support to get rid of the people in the benchlands. That's what it seems like, but I don't know any more details than that.
Now, you also mentioned that you heard from a council member that there may be some quick attack on Food Not Bomb, sort of a shock and awe thing.
Yeah, but I can't get Sandy to call me back yet, so I don't know what's going on with that. That's one other thing. Yeah.
Any word from Food Not Bomb's organizations inside Ukraine, Belarus, or Russia?
The videos of Moscow Food Not Bombs being arrested and having their stuff taken. And I believe there is an update on whether they got out of jail or not, but I'm afraid I haven't followed that as closely as I could.
Because
I'm trying to find a kitchen. That's, I think, the biggest story is we need a commercial kitchen. We have a permit for any commercial kitchen that has already been, looked at by the county. So we're just preparing a church permit is transferable according to the environmental health. So we are just looking for that. That's a big one.
Why is the Red Church no longer usable?
They want to do their ministry there, is what they said, which I think is their Monday meal coffee house. But we offered to do it for them or with them or even without them. But I haven't heard that yet from that.
So it's a possibility that would it only be Monday you need a commercial kitchen, or are they kicking you out generally?
No, we're kicked out in 60 days, which was like 15 days ago.
Wow.
Permanently.
When did you?
And we didn't know that someday the end of the pandemic. It's just bad time because dealing with we were just in the middle of between two evictions of a meal location, and then the. And then also, it seems like more and more people need food. We're running out of every kind of resource. The whole thing is, out of control. So, it's just bad timing. It's like when the economic collapse is happening, it's kind of a drag. The church kicks you out just so they can serve a meal on Monday. It's apparently what they're doing, but I don't know. I mean, they'll probably have weddings and things like that. Although I'm sure we could have worked around them, but...
Had they in fact advised you this 2 weeks ago, or what was the story?
We got notice on the 15th in February, and we're working like crazy trying to find a new place.
Huh. Because I remember I was at one or two of your Food Not Bombs Monday meetings, and I guess maybe I got in late, but I never heard that it mentioned that Cavalry was ousting you. I was.
Yeah, you may have come on with Dave before we were ousted or something like that, too, so it's hard to say.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a story there.
Are you...
All that, and then...
Are you at the town clock?
I don't know what this... Trip is with Ready.gov and Homeland Security putting out crap about what to do in the event of a nuclear explosion. What a fucking thing!
Duck and cover, man. Duck and cover.
Not so much that it. The idea that they put that out now during this situation seems very bizarre. It seems like they should just keep their mouths shut about that. Unless they really think something's going to go on. Seems like just some psychological attack on the people that happen to come across that document.
You've mentioned that there was a protest on several protests on Sunday. One at the town clock, that was on the 27th of February, and then one at the in front of the movie theater. And they were, of course, separate protests. One was U.S. out of NATO. I was there with. I had a mixed message in my protesting. But the main and larger protest had the folks who were opposed to Putin's invasion of the Ukraine. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. It's the first time that pro-U.S. people are doing anti-war protests. It's very strange, So people it appears, it's essentially trying to endorse the idea essentially when I try to talk to them, about the coup, U.S. coup of Ukraine, and the simple fact that the United States would not promise Russia that they would never accept Ukraine into NATO, plays a huge role in this entire conflict, but that's not of interest. And then I'm hearing NPR running all this stuff about the gray protesters outside the White House, that want some kind of greater war, but that basically these protests that are you know, against Russia are calling for a greater war. So they're not really peace protests because they want a greater war against Russia. So that's, and we're, ours are like against NATO and against the war. So it's really, it's terrible. But then at the same time, of course, it's amazing what Fuda Bomb is doing handling the refugee crisis in the area because, you know, we were already feeding refugees from other situations in Poland and, you know, we're feeding people in Poland and, you know, all that. So there's a lot of images coming out of the Fuda Bomb groups in the country surrounding the conflict. But it's just a shame, you know. I mean, and the fact that the United States, the people of the United States really are, you know, been kept in the dark about these, you know, the fuck you tapes, you know, where Victoria Nuland gives the okay to, you know, says that Biden given the green light and the coup should happen, and then they were.
You're talking about events back in 2014.
Yeah, that set this off, and then the U.S. kept like arming the Ukrainian government, which was bombing the crap out of the Russian area of Ukraine for the whole time, ever since the 2014. Yeah, and you know, it was a very bloody and violent coup backed and organized by the U.S. putting in their own person, who was one of the richest billionaires in the world. So that's what now we've come to this point. And that's not to say that we're like, I'm into Putin because we've had, you know, neo-Nazi types, white supremacists in Russia get away with murdering Fuda Bomb people when they're serving free food, although in one case, after a huge political organizing effort globally, they did finally arrest the people that killed two more in St. Petersburg in 2007. He was Ukrainian, actually. He's from Chernobyl.
So is
anyway, and he had the punk band Sandinista. Is kind of what he's
pointing. Is Russia's Food Now Bombs actually operating now or not?
Well, I saw it was like a few days ago a video on Twitter of Moscow Food Now Bombs denouncing the war and getting arrested for the banner that was denouncing the war.
Were they also denouncing NATO or just Russia's involvement?
Yeah, just Russia's involvement, which makes sense. You know, I don't fault anybody in Russia being against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That completely makes sense. It's just that Americans should be not siding with the United States playing their role in this thing. That's the thing. Because the whole thing wouldn't even be happening if, for instance, after the Soviet Union fell in 91, when the U.S. See, the whole thing is the U.S. agreed not to go in to expand NATO, and at the end of the, but they didn't sign the papers, and essentially that's what Putin was wanting a written agreement that because they, you know, U.S. moved into Poland and moved into, NATO moved into all these countries, right? At pretty much the control of the United States. So now you've got that, now you're in this situation where you have a threat of global nuclear war and all that because of geopolitics that is, you know, the only timing thing that I can think of as practical is the fact that the, you know, that Nord Stream 2 was about to go online and that would have made a much tighter economic and political relationship between Germany and Russia.
And Nord Stream 2 is the oil pipeline to go through Germany?
Yeah.
Or one of the numerous pipelines. There are actually a number of pipelines that are going.
Yeah, it's number two. You know, there's also number one.
And there's one through the Baltic, and there's one through Ukraine. And
yeah, there's one through Ukraine. And a lot, back then, the coup was happening. It was really interesting. In 2014, you had these massive hundreds of thousands of people protesting in Brussels and other capitals, Western capitals, against the austerity programs of the euro, the eurozone.
Mm-hmm. As well as lots of people in the Maidan protests, too.
Yeah, Maidan protests, and then the burning of the trade union by that neo-Nazi faction that burned down the trade union in Odessa. So the thing that was that happened was, so it's just it's been going on like that, like crazy for the poor people. I know him.
What I heard recently today in a debate or discussion I was having with someone of a different perspective, he was pointing out that he isn't really much of a political person, but what he got from the mainstream media was an assertion that Ukraine had made a treaty with Russia that they would give back their nuclear weapons in 2004 if there was a non-invasion agreement. Do you remember such a thing happening?
Yeah, well, Ukraine did give their weapons to Russia. That's definitely happened. Yeah.
And so they are violating their agreement, Keith. Now, come on.
So in the Minsk agreement, but then the U.S. is now trying to put more weapons in there. I mean, that made sense, and it should have happened all along the Warsaw Pact, right? So the U.S., the Warsaw Pact dissolved, right?
Yeah.
And the part of their promise of dissolving the Warsaw Pact was to have those countries be the buffer between NATO and Russia. And then the United States just never honored that.
I thought that was part of the, when I was reading it, apparently there were documents released in 2017 that were showing some of the discussions between the various heads of state in 1990, and 91, when these discussions were happening, when the Soviet Union was breaking up or about to break up. And part of that was mainly about German unification, that Germany would never join, East Germany would never join NATO. And of course,
that definitely was one of the things.
Yeah. It wasn't so much about Poland and the other countries, but about, in other words, there were different discussions about that. I haven't parsed those documents, so that's what I'm looking at, admittedly, a right-wing analysis of them, because some people on the right don't like the invasion of, they don't like, you know, the U.S. involvement in the Ukraine, and they're not too happy about NATO either, but they also have a somewhat different perspective on it. You're familiar with, you know, Ron Paul, libertarians who are against American military expansion overseas, but their economic views are considerably different than probably yours and mine. So.
Yeah, well, you know, I've just been following this conflict for years, and that's my opinion on what I've been noticing, but... Yeah. So anyway, I should probably go. It's a way that it's just a shame, you know, that I don't know what the theory of penetrating, you know, putting social media crap about what to do.
If you have more stuff about local stuff, like if you learn more from Councilmember Brown, you mentioned she may have some thoughts about what the latest plans for the city regarding food not bombs are, and because we may, you know, you may want to put that out more broadly. I imagine you probably will.
Oh, yeah. If I could get a hold of her, I would definitely do that.
Definitely. You've called her, but she's not called you back yet. That's been the story.
Yes. Yeah. And one person went to talk to her, and she said, one of the messages was call me back. No, that didn't happen.
I got you. Well,
I better go. I got, like, you know, I've got this thing that's bleeding down. I got to get down. I've got no hands free.
Listen, I'll let you go. Thank you for doing the feeding. So throughout the course of this netcast, I'm going to be playing you selections from Remembering Sacco and Vanzetti in Song and Story. It's a live performance by Charlie King and Karen Brandau, and I've played some of their stuff before. This is kind of the whole album that contains songs and I guess some commentary. They write initially, Sacco and Vanzetti, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, became part of my life in the summer of 1977 when I worked with a group commemorating the 50th anniversary of their death. We went into the streets in Middletown, Connecticut, and in Boston, Massachusetts, with songs, poetry, readings, and street theater. We vigiled in silence at the Massachusetts State House at midnight, August 22nd, to remember their execution. I learned some Woody Guthrie songs and wrote one of my own. Although I grew up in Massachusetts, in Brockton and Plymouth, I had never been told the story of these labor heroes who walked the same streets that I did, who shared many of the same dreams. A quarter century later, Karen and I remember Nick and Bart as we work against capital punishment for workers' rights, against war. This past year, we have witnessed the mass arrest without due process of immigrants and dissidents. This is written in July 4th, 2002, in the wake of the 9/11 hysteria that swept the country. This past year, 2002, we have witnessed the mass street arrest without due process of immigrants and dissidents, the launching of another war, the widening gulf of rich and poor, the stifling of civil liberties and labor rights, and the clamor for executions. It seems we have not learned much in the 75 years since two good men were electrocuted for their dreams, their politics, and their ethnicity. We hope that by remembering Sacco and Vanzetti, we can understand and change. Charlie King, Karen Brandow, July 4th, 2002. And we're going to work our way through this, some of it anyway, on this particular show. Here we go.
Hey there, did you hear the news? Sacco worked at trimming shoes. Vanzetti was a peddling man. He pushed a fish cart with his hands. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Sacco and Vanzetti are gone. Left me here to sing this song. Woody wants you to sing that with us. Two good men a long time gone. Sing it again. Two good men a long time gone. Sacco and Vanzetti. Sacco and Vanzetti are gone. Left me here to sing this song. Sacco's born across the sea, somewhere over in Italy. Vanzetti, born of parents fine, they drank the best Italian wine. Sacco sailed the sea one day, landed up in Boston Bay. Vanzetti sailed the ocean blue, and he ended up in Boston too. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Sacco and Vanzetti are gone. Left me here to sing this song. Vanzetti. I was born on June 11, 1888, in Via Folletto. The town is primarily an agricultural community. I attended the local schools, and I loved study. My father was undecided whether to let me continue in my studies or to apprentice me to some artisan. One day, he read in the Gazzetto del Popolo that in Turin, 42 lawyers had applied for a position paying 35 lira monthly. The news item proved decisive in my boyhood, for it left my father determined that I should learn a trade and become a shopkeeper.
There were no extremes of riches and poverty in Torre Maggiore. If by chance any resident grew unusually rich, he was likely to move to Bari or Napoli or some other city. The Saccos were among the more substantial portion of the population. Their lands were among the widest in town, and their olive and wine business thrived. Often, young Nicola went round the country in a jogging cart to pay off hired workmen or to buy supplies. He was the trusted son. Exceptionally strong, buoyant, healthy, intelligent, and less given to moping and doubting than other boys. The real concrete things interested him most: the tools and machinery and trees.
Nicola Sacco and his brother Sabino landed in Boston in April 1908. 2 months later, Vanzetti arrived in New York. Nicola was 17 years old. Vanzetti was 20. They did not meet for several years, but the story of nearly every immigrant immediately after reaching America is similar.
Like a scene from a costume ball, decked out in the colors of Europe and on fire with the hope of it all.
There my father's own father stood huddled with the tired, the hungry, and the scared. Turn of the century pilgrims, bound by the dreams that they share. Sometimes when I look in my grandfather's immigrant eyes, I see that day reflected. I can't hold my feelings inside. I see starting with loving and working hard all of his life. Don't take it for granted, say grandfather's immigrant eyes. They were standing in lines just like cattle, groped and sorted and shoved. Some were one desk away from sweet freedom. Some were told, some were they left. From that sprawling tower of Babel came a young man, confused and alone, determined and bound for America, carrying
And the songs were Two Good Men by Woody Guthrie. He wrote it, actually. He didn't sing it, at least not in this particular version. Although he did release 11 songs later released as an album, Ballads of Sacco and Vanzetti, did Woody Guthrie. And according to the narrative here, this weaves through the recording as a narrative thread. And the second song is about Ellis Island. It's called Immigrant Eyes, the one you just heard. It's Ellis Island Remembered. And it was written by Guy Clark. And here briefly, since we're going to be playing more about Sacco and Vanzetti as seen through the, well, heard through the music on this album, Remembering Sacco Vanzetti in Song and Story, here's a little something that describes a summary. It's called the Sacco Vanzetti Trial. It's by Study Mode Research. The Sacco Vanzetti affair is the most famous and controversial case in American legal history. I don't know about that. It's certainly one I've heard about. In our history, justice has not always resulted in fairness, but instead in the denial of the rights of ordinary citizens. In the 1920s, a tumultuous decade of social unrest, numerous Americans were discriminated against for their political or religious beliefs and ethnicity. It was a decade of intense nationalism in which the rights of immigrants were violated in such events as the Red Scare and Palmer Raids. In May of 1920, and the songs were Two Good Men and Ballads of 1920 against for their political or religious beliefs and ethnicity. It was a decade of intense nationalism in which the rights of immigrants were violated in such events as the Red Scare and Palmer Raids. In May of 1920, the infamous trial and conviction of Italian immigrants Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti began. Since this time, there has been much controversy as to their guilt. Could they have truly received a jury trial? And you'll be hearing more about that as we hear more music and songs from Charlie King and Karen Brandow. I'm here at the town clock. It's a sunny Sunday, perhaps a little too sunny for a guy in a terry cloth bathrobe, which is what I'm also wearing. I'm next to my old associate. I don't know what I got. What I used to call you, James. I called you something. Jumping Jehoshaphat, James. Nay, no, it's something else. You're, of course, 20 years ago.
Happy with James.
James, you are James. You, of course, were doing a lot of cabling with Huff in the old days and cop watching and things of that sort. Right now you're hanging out in Watsonville at a motel. Was that, did that happen after COVID? Or?
Yeah. Well, I went to the hospital. I got kind of sick and things wrong and ended up in the hospital with an infected lung and things.
And you are? How are you doing now?
Much better. Actually, yeah. That's
COVID-related or otherwise related?
No COVID-related at all. Just nobody falling apart from me beating it up when I was young.
Young.
A lot of those cops beating on me, you know. So I got my left lung's kind of shot and keeps filling up with shit. And I have to drain it. And I got other things. But
so
I'm getting better.
What brings you to the town clock today?
My son Josh.
You didn't mention that Pops was in the car, and who the hell is Pops? I didn't pick up on the fact that he has a pop. I know you. I know him.
Yep.
Now, Josh has been occasionally working with the Union of the Homeless, I guess. Is it on again, off again with Alicia at this point? Or?
Yeah, that's it. On again, off again.
And he, of course, has given half of his recent court settlement to you.
No. Yeah. He hasn't given me a dime. But he's doing well, and I'm happy with that. So that's the way I look at that. You know, I never was interested in money. So
now, was the court settlement a surprise to you and him?
Not really. It's, I don't want to say too much. It was quick. So it was great for the moment.
Have some kind of a gag order in place?
Not a gag order per se, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. I really can't say much more than that, but they think that was the end of it, and it's not. They're about to be really surprised.
I would love to hear it. When is this surprise likely to be revealed?
Oh, very soon. It'll hit the papers after it hits courts. But
now, what I heard before was that Josh got $100,000, $80,000, or some such settlement.
Actually, yes, they made it. But after they made the settlement and before they paid him $100,000, he gets jumped by these frickin' officers again, and it was all a million people just flipped out their phones and filmed it this time for jaywalking.
Names of the officers?
Well, I couldn't tell you that. He could. It's all on film.
Who filmed it?
A million different people.
Yeah, really?
At least seven people there at the scene from beginning to end and past, you know, and with officers' names. But it was, what happened was, it immediately went to the city, and the city went, oh, shit, because the guy that started it, the guy who started it was the head guy in what they were paying $100,000 for, to not go to court. And so then it suddenly jumped to, I think it was $210,000 plus attorney fees. And that's what they paid out.
Well, he naturally took you out to dinner,
didn't he? I think he took me out once, but it doesn't matter. You know, that's his money and I don't want it. And, you know, I don't never ask for much money. I get by on what I got and give away half of that.
One of those old hippie types?
Yeah, that's me. I just, you know, I don't see no purpose in material things and greed. You know, that's what God talks about the most, is greed. And I know you don't greed in God, but my God says you don't greed, and that's number one. Not all this other bullshit that's not even shit he's talking about. Greed and treating people like brothers and sisters.
Let me ask you the key question regarding this whole scene with Josh and these cops. Are they still on the force?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Isn't that wonderful? But there's more to come, so stay tuned. I will give you a pre-warning for stage two, and it's going to...
And this was all attorney Jonathan Gettleman.
Yes. That's
or Elizabeth Caballero, one of the two.
No, Jonathan. Jonathan is the one that started it. He came to us.
Really?
Well, he was our appeals court attorney. Because almost everything they charged you, we've appealed and won. Okay?
Now, we're talking about appeal of a civil suit, or was it with Josh?
Criminal
thing. What was Josh criminally charged with?
Never was anything that came down to. He was never charged with anything.
They dropped all the charges.
Well, yeah, they after they beat him, and after it was filmed, and they beat him 4 minutes past unconsciousness, while the videotapes and the chest cams have him, oh, you know he's an epileptic, you know he's, before he goes unconscious. And you know he's having seizures, and the guy's laughing and saying, so what, and booting him some more. And anyway, the videotapes are there.
This was the first and the second beating.
This is the first.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole force was there. Every single car in the town that day was at the site.
Well, it's a lesson for the rookies.
And what he'd supposedly done was a bus had hit him, and he went into Petty Mall and drove around the block and pulled in. You know, it was there at Trader Joe's, what comes together on Front Street.
Yeah.
Across the light, it comes down, and the bus came over and hit him. And he went into a Petty Mall, drove around the block, pulled into where the old theater was. It's the Laugh Club, whatever now, comedy club. And they, whoo, yeah, jumped out.
When was this?
Oh, about 2 years ago.
And were you present, or we just heard of it?
Nope. I saw the videotapes.
Who was videoing?
Well, we got everybody. There was a number of people. It started with, we were up on the west side, and this guy came up and said, you know, I was there and saw the whole thing. You know, your son was unconscious, and they kept right on beating him. He had just got off work from a business.
Someone who knew you from before?
No, we just heard us talking about it and realized we were the family of the victim that he had seen get this done to him. He was an employee right there by, I don't want to say where or what, I don't use his name, but, and he had just come off duty, and when he heard us talking, chose to come over and say, hey, you know, I was there when it happened.
With a video camera.
And then it turned, then he turned, you know, half a dozen other people turned up, and we got all of the officers' cams. Cars, chests, everything. And their tapes. And they just, that's what I said, they fucked themselves with their own tapes. Hearing them say, so what, and kicking him again. When he's, you know, he's having a seizure, he's epileptic, he's unconscious. 4 minutes past unconscious, they beat him.
This was on the first episode.
Yeah. For being hit by a bus and leaving the scene, going around the block.
Well, how could he have the temerity to be hit by a bus?
So,
I mean, the guy obviously doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
This people don't belong in our town.
If we have an accident, we should all be beaten almost to death.
Oh, that's an adequate punishment. Perhaps a little harsh in some respects. So how long until the second episode happened?
Oh, I don't know. A couple of weeks.
No way. Really?
Yeah, the city was that fast. They wanted to cover it up. They were just going to shell out $100,000 and shut the hell up. And yeah, because by then we had videotapes and everything. Well, they didn't know we had an attorney.
So,
but it was a good attorney.
So the second incident happened in spite of the $100,000 settlement.
Yes. It just had not been paid out yet. It had been offered. Okay? And, yeah, he's crossing the street from Jack in the Box towards the courthouse. And the guy comes flying. And he's even, in all the videos, he's all, no, leave me alone. Don't hurt me. I know who you are. And trying to get away. And then still tied down and kicking the hit and punch.
Well, think of it as a training exercise.
Cameras, yeah. Yeah. For the takeover they're trying to plan. I mean, let's screw the homeless. That's the problem, is the rich. Anybody who makes more than $1 million is the problem. That's just plain fact. Okay? You take more resources than is yours, somebody has to starve to death. The earth produces enough food to feed every human being on the planet every day 10 times over. The only reason people starve to death is because of greed. Because of these big mucky mucks taking $1 million salaries. Multi-million is really the word. But I mean, and everybody revering all these people on TV that get 14, 15 million a year. 65% of America, hardworking, salt to the earth, never miss a day, total up at the end of their death, and it doesn't total $1 million.
They get a gold watch.
Rarely. Usually they get booted out just before retirement, so they get no retirement anymore.
That's a very cynical view.
It's the truth. Okay, it's not just cynical, it's truth. So we need to wake up and start noticing. And notice things like, because I speak bad about most, but when something does good, look at Domino's. Want to know an interesting fact about Domino's?
Domino's pizza?
Yeah, I know it's crappy pizza, everybody says it, whatever. Mm-hmm. But 95% of all franchise owners started as a delivery driver or on the line.
As
new owners, new franchise owners, all the owners said 95% of the people owning Taco Bell franchises all started either as a delivery driver or on the line. 95% of that company, they hire their people. They bring them up, they get them stores. That's corporate policy. That's good corporate. Let's not take every dime away from the earth. Let's put a little back and let's raise these people up. That's what I do well. But I'm getting better. I can get up and walk around. I have a walker, but mostly I need to walk because I get tired real fast. You know, no lung, no breath. They want me to go.
Have you had a lung removed?
No, they go in and stick this hose down and it's horrible. And suck all the goop out of my.
How often?
And replay. I've had it done twice now in the last 3 years.
Oh, wow. And it's painful?
Yeah.
Great.
Very painful, yeah. Very uncomfortable.
Have a street spirit. It's
I always go for a street spirit.
And I expect you need to actually write your own article, but nonetheless.
Yeah, I'll think about it. No, I don't write well, but the more I am because I'm there so much alone, got so much time, I probably could.
And the wind kind of blew away most of the rest of the conversation with James Ney. James was an activist around the turn of the millennium, 2000, with me. He spent a lot of time. He wasn't afraid to risk jail by peaceful activism. He was arrested for chalking in the sleeping ban on the sidewalk in front of what was then the Hosts Center. The Hosts were this kind of paramilitary, a precursor to the Ambassadors. They walked around and they were the eyes and ears of the police department, just as the Ambassadors. I don't know if we still have the Ambassadors. I'm not entirely clear on that. But these are sort of a group hired by the merchants and even sponsored by the city to some extent through the Downtown Management Corporation, or that's they were that the Hosts were anywhere away as they call themselves, who were supposed to. Advise people, get up off the sidewalk, you're not supposed to be sitting here. They would call the police if people didn't snap to it when they gave the latest rules under the downtown ordinances passed by the city council in 1994 and strengthened in 2002 and made worse in the coming years and that are still on the books and still need to be eliminated. But James Ney was a fighter about that, against that, and also concerned about ending the most... what I always regarded as one of the most flagrant violations was the city's sleeping ban provisions of the camping ordinance, which made it an actual crime to fall asleep after 11 o'clock at night. That has been removed from the camping ordinance, but it's actually been sort of needed and fashioned so that it has a similar effect, and it's still a crime to sleep in your vehicle on private property. That the word sleep as a crime has reappeared there, and it's kind of interesting. In any case, let's take another Sacco and Vanzetti musical break, perhaps learn a little bit more about what at least some folks thought about them, specifically Charlie King and Karen Brandow.
Vanzetti. In the immigration station, I had my first great surprise. I saw the steerage passengers, handled by the officials like so many animals. Not a word of kindness, of encouragement, to lighten the burden of tears that rests heavily upon the newly arrived on American shores. Hope, which lured these immigrants to the new land, withers under the touch of harsh officials. Little children, who should be alert with expectancy, cling instead to their mother's skirts, weeping with fright. Such is the unfriendly spirit that exists in the immigration barracks.
1912, Lawrence, Massachusetts. Immigrant women worked in all the mills in town under harsh and unfair conditions. 17 languages were spoken on the shop floor. Still, they organized a wildcat strike and took to the streets in an action that captured the attention of the nation.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened presents, a thousand millions gray, are touched by all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, red and roses, red and roses.
cannot be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater glories, bread and roses, bread and roses.
Immigrant labor continues to be the bedrock and the future of organized labor today. Yanira Marino's story is typical. She fled her home in El Salvador when the repression of the U.S.-supported regime there threatened her life. She came to make a new life in Southern California.
Ah, they laugh and they tell us the unions are dead. Now it's every man for himself. Well, here in L.A., there's a new union made. And I tell you, folks, she's something else. Her name is Yanira, a daring Latina. She knows her strength and her worth. She's younger but wiser, a born organizer, the kind we call salt of the earth. Hey, Yanira, I just want to say your name. Yanira, daughter of El. Speaking his mind, she ran north across Mexico. The death squad pursued her and did some things to her I don't think that you'd want to know. But her spirit's unbroken, she's brave and unspoken, a steady, unquenchable flame. And she brought that fire to the sweatshop that hired her. They'll never forget her name. It's Yanira. Hey, don't you want to sing her name? Yanira. Yanira, daughter of El Salvador. Yanira. Yanira. Nothing ever will be the same. Two kids, no job. She hired on at a shrimp packing plant, where the boss, he was rude, and the foreman was lewd. The perks and the wages were scant. But her bright smile would shine to her friends on the line. How long, good people, how long? They can put any crime on us one at a time. But in union, we are strong, Yanira. Oh, come on and sing her name. Yanira. Yanira, daughter of El Salvador. Yanira,
White House wall. Then the five each brought four to show up at the door of the Labor's Union Hall. 25 takes the game if they each take three names to sign up for a fight they can win. Oh, it snowballed in time till at last 89 voted yes, the union was in. Hey, Anita, they all want to sing your name. Hey, viva, Anita. Hey, viva, Anita. Shrimp anymore. She's packing the Union Hall. There is nobody braver for immigrant labor. The immigrant stands for us all. So the hell with the law that would padlock the door. Tell me which side are you on? Oh, it could be clearer. Let's side with Yanira and the courage to carry it on. Hey, Yanira, I just want to sing your song. Yanira, Lord El Salvador. Yanira, nothing ever will be the same.
And those two songs were Bread and Roses, 1915 song by James Oppenheim, music by Mimi Farania. And the other was Yanira Marino, and that was by Charlie King, 1997. So now it's back to the town clock on February 27th. I spent some time talking with, well, actually very little time, but a bit of time talking with, well, what do we call him, Tenderized Thomas. This a fellow who was working for a time as an employee of the Association of Faith Community Shelter Program, and then ended up at the Coral Street Pauley Loft. And it's unfortunately a little hard to hear the initial part of this, to say the least, because it's so windy, but it does get better, so bear with the dialogue and you'll actually eventually begin to understand it. You're outside?
No, I'm still kind of in a
shelter program.
How is the shelter? Prison light.
Prison light. Can you describe for me why that you would describe it as prison light? So that we can have you kicked out of the program immediately. Let's put this way. What are the deficiencies of the program? What needs to be improved?
The food, for one thing, it's really bad. Although the cook is really good, but he doesn't get much good stuff to work with.
Hence, you come to Food Not Bombs?
Yeah. Actually, Food Not Bombs food is better in general. I only started coming here since they moved here from over there, you know. Because I haven't been over there for a long time. Can I get some more of those alphabet crackers?
Why don't you have chocolate? What's going on here?
Thank you.
So, how many people are in the shelter?
There's got to be at least 100 people. I mean, there's like three different programs. There's Page Smith, there's RCC, there's the POC. There used to be the shelter, the actual original River Street shelter. It's been closed down for almost a year now. The beautiful garden there is just so unkept.
We're talking about Coral Street?
Mm-hmm.
That's, we're talking about Pauley Loft?
Yeah. The loft.
How is it? I mean, we used to have a problem with disabled access.
They got a lot of people that are in wheelchairs over there, so I wouldn't say there's...
How did they do that? Did they change the way they set up, the way it works?
Well, probably most of the people in wheelchairs have what they call these pallets. I don't know where they get that name for it, but they're like little tool sheds.
How many of them are there, do you know?
There's like 40.
Are they needed?
Hell no.
No?
Hell no. They're cold. They're like a little ice box. That's part of the reason I call it prison life. I mean, the only good thing about it is it's like you got your own space when you know you can go in here and close the door and, you know, sort of close the world out. But the freeway noise is so unbearable to me. That's the worst part. I hate it.
How long have you been there?
Way too long.
Is this a pathway to housing?
Supposed to be, and some people do get something, but...
All right!
An actual honk.
I mean, some people have gotten some housing, I guess, but I don't know if a whole lot of people have. And what I'm looking for is not the usual whatever. I'm really trying to find a community to live in. They are, you know, sympathetic, and they're trying to help me with that, but it hasn't been working so far.
Yeah.
Not really.
We're picking up fallen papers here.
I mean, I've just been so depressed, and that's like my biggest problem.
Well, you've always had, you know, you've not been the happiest guy that I remember generally, probably because circumstances are in.
Yeah, but
thank you, boy. Wow. So you're suggesting food problems, maybe inferentially heat problems. Maybe if you were there in the summer, how is it as far as fuel is overheating there?
There's windows that you can open, so you can get air in there, but...
Windows are just open spaces.
No, there's windows that with screens that you can, like, open. They're good little windows. But it gets moldy in the wintertime. I had to move from one room to another because the mold was so bad this year. But they were very accommodating about it. You know, they were very helpful about having me move to another room. So it's fine. But I'm so tired of being there. I can't stand all the noise. You can't have it. You can come and go whenever you want. There's no time limits on that. They have, like, somebody at the gate all the time. So
identify yourself and such.
Yeah, whenever you come in.
Show you papers?
Like, I always carry my little ID card. But
and what the wind pushed away was the fact that you can't have visitors. And I think they discourage people inside this pallet village, if you will, or this pallet encampment, or this pallet enclosure that is now at 115 Coral Street. I think it was created as a sort of a response to the COVID danger of group shelters, which was something that we at both at Huff and the Union of the Homeless and Food Now Bombs were concerned about a couple years ago. Although it turned out there was, at least in homeless shelters in Santa Cruz, not much COVID that we heard of. I think there were a couple cases, but it didn't spread the way we feared it would. It wasn't as quick to appear as we feared it would be.
Even if you just tell them your name and they find it on the computer, they'll say, okay, you're good.
No, I put the word out to everybody online and everything. But
and,
I don't know what goes on with all that.
Well, it's probably
nothing. Oh, no.
Yeah.
You've covered it, I think. I mean, you know, you covered some of it.
Yeah. I'm just so tired of being there, but I don't know where to go yet. instead.
Yeah, we are waiting for you at the Huff meeting to come back and get our advice.
Okay. Yeah, I've been meaning to, and I know somebody who I think really would be a good contribution because he wants to talk about
7 o'clock on Thursday.
I told him already. I said, you know, I might not make it there as soon as you do, but go. And his name's Russell, in case he does show up.
It's not the Russell Cooper.
No, not that one. Totally different Russell. Totally different.
The other voices you're hearing come from the small peace demonstration. There were folks holding up signs opposing the war. The NATO involvement in the war in the Ukraine, the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. It was an anti-war protest, a smaller sort than I'm used to even in the relatively small Santa Cruz war protests. And indeed, I think at another point in town, there was a larger anti-war protest, which was more concerned with denouncing Putin and the invasion than in looking at the precursors to the invasion, such as the creep of NATO up to the Russian border, the Ukrainian government's repression of Russian-speaking folks in the separatist region bordering Russia in the eastern Ukraine. But in any case, at least some anti-war protests are gathering strength in Santa Cruz. I don't know about gathering strength. They're appearing, and maybe they'll eventually start gathering strength. That would be good if that were happening. There is another one, of course, coming up on Sunday at the town clock. That's from 12 to 3, when Food Now Bombs normally serves. So the flyer reads, "Peace with Russia and NATO and the wars. Join our Global Day of Action Sunday. Stop the war in Ukraine. Russian troops out. No to NATO expansion. An international anti-war Zoom meeting on February 26th, attended by thousands and organized by Code Pink, Stop the War Coalition, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and the No to NATO Network agreed to an international day of anti-war action on Sunday, March 6th. We call on everyone who opposes this war to take to the streets on March 6th in a massive display of global opposition to the war and the warmongers. The war in Ukraine is a disaster for the people of Ukraine and a terrible threat to us all, including increasing the danger of nuclear war. We oppose the Russian invasion and call for the immediate withdrawal of all Russian troops. We recognize that the expansion of NATO and the aggressive approach of Western states have caused the crisis, and we demand an end to NATO expansion. We also oppose sanctions that will harm ordinary Russians and call on all countries to welcome refugees fleeing the war. There have already been many anti-war demonstrations in Russia and many other countries. What we need now is a massive unified response by peace-loving people around the world to say no to the war in Ukraine, yes to negotiations and peace." And again, this is starting at 1 o'clock, not at 12, as I said before, at the town clock on March 6th, Sunday. So this protest last Sunday, which is what you're hearing now, is sort of a precursor to the one coming up this next Sunday, which will be the day after tomorrow. And here's a little more from that particularly windy day.
Madam, which is no nukes.
I want my grandchildren to live.
Benjamin Rush.
And other people's grandchildren.
He met the... When the Senate was
going to be a lot of interest at the moment. I see there is someone on the median still doing push-ups. That's, goodness gracious, that's indeed Fox, the impresario.
Some would say a show-off. Others would say he's showing his shit.
For what?
He's just exercising in a public way and also exercising his civil liberties because he is on the median, which is illegal.
I see a mirror over there.
And Washington
you see that?
Mirror?
A mirror, look.
They would have never made it.
I do too.
So that's on a sign.
Not sure what the signature
is.
Tell me your new anywhere, Rob Drew.
Pull out.
pooter for you. Take it in the pooter. You're invading the wrong country. They're going to kick you in the ass. I'm sorry, but that's what, I mean, I hate to say it, but they will fight for their homeland. And it's a stupid invasion on Pooter's part, I'd say. So I changed his name to Pooter. Is that Putin? Pooter. Mr. Pooter.
Very disrespectful comment about our future.
What's that?
A very disrespectful comment.
Yeah, well,
shocking.
I he made the wrong decision to invade that country, I believe. Because what's the point? Why did all those people have to die? For nothing.
Now, there's a war going on in the Donbass, which the Ukrainian government is supporting. That's the problem. And they have called for Russian intervention. Now, the Russians should have intervened there and not intervened heading for Kiev. That's what I think.
I don't know all the details. All I know is they're fighting for their homeland. Russians should not be there, I don't think. What do you think?
Well, I think the Eastern Republics called them and said, come and help us because we're getting the shit shelled out of us. So they came in there and said, that's why we're doing that. We just want to protect you. But then they also headed for Kiev from the north.
Right.
Which indicated they had larger aims in mind.
I couldn't believe the Russian tank I watched the other day just run over this 70-year-old man in his little, you know, Toyota car. Just purposely aimed the tank at the guy and ran him right over. And thank God the guy lived, but boy, his car looked like it was crushed to a T, you know. It's crazy.
Have you been doing much singing, Joe, around town?
I am on my way to go play. I love playing electrically, you know. That's what I've really been mastering lately. It's a lot of electric work.
Do they require a permit for electrician?
No.
Yeah. They've pulled that shit on some of us in the past.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now it's a legal thing, they say. It's freedom of expression, so they actually had a court case go through, and now they're not messing with people playing electric.
Well, that's good. Do you know the name of the court case?
You know, I can't remember. It was just over people playing music.
And we've been talking with?
Guitar Joe.
That's good.
The days after my arrival, 3 days after my arrival, a countryman found me a post in his kitchen as a dishwasher in New York City. The hours were long. There was not a single window in it. When the electric light, for some reason, was out, it was totally dark, so that we couldn't move without running into things. The sinks had no direct sewage connection. Instead, the water was permitted to overflow onto the floor. We worked 12 hours one day and 14 the next, with 5 hours off every other Sunday. Damp food, hardly fit for dogs, and $5 or $6 a week was the pay. After 8 months, I left the place for fear of contracting consumption. That was a sad year. What toiler does not remember it? The poor slept outdoors and rummaged the garbage barrels to find a cabbage leaf or a rotten potato.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, so I followed along. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. So why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it rocks, I built a tower. Now it's done, buddy. Can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee noodling tongue. Half a million boots went slogging through hell. I was a kid with a drum. Well, you know, it really burns me how I got to dig so deep to pay a man who makes a half a million in his sleep. I cannot even buy a beer. For me, it's priced too high, 'cause I'm busy paying off my boss's fancy scotch and rye. And it's out of your pockets. Money remaining in my pockets, I took a steamboat for Hartford, Connecticut. From town to town, village to village, farm to farm we went. We knocked at factory doors and were sent away. Nothing doing, nothing doing. We arrived in Middletown, tired, bruised, hungry, and dripping from 3 hours walk in the rain. We asked about the chances for obtaining work in that vicinity. They told us there was not a stitch to be had, and advised trying in Springfield, Connecticut, where there are 3 brick furnaces. I secured work at the furnaces, one of the most exacting jobs I know. I remained there 10 months. I went to Meriden, where I worked in some stone pits, 2 years in the stone pits, doing the hardest unskilled labor. Perhaps they who worked beside me in the pits and at the furnaces saw in my eyes the great dreams that were already in my imagination for a world where all of us would live a cleaner, less animal existence.
I travel around this country from shore to shore. men will own those banks of marble with no guard at any door, and we'll share those halls of silver that we've all been sweating for.
Sackles, why? Two children had. Sackle was a family man. Vans, and he was a dreaming man. His books were always in his hands. Sackle made his bread and butter, being the factory's best shoe cutter. Vans, and he spoke day and night, told the workers they should fight. Two good men a long time gone home. Two good men a long time gone.
Sacco and Vanzetti.
Sacco and Vanzetti are gone. Left me here to sing this song.
Vanzetti. My active participation in the Plymouth Cordage strike made it certain that I could never get a job there. As a matter of fact, because of my more frequent appearance on the speaker's platform in working class groups of every kind, it became increasingly difficult to get work anywhere. So far as certain factories were concerned, I was definitely blacklisted. Yet, every one of my many employers could testify that I was an industrious, dependable workman, that my chief fault was in trying so hard to bring a little light of understanding into the dark lives of my fellow workers.
Vanzetti, we believe more now than ever that war is wrong, and we are against war now more than ever. All that they say to you, all that they have promised to you, it was a lie. It was an illusion. It was a cheat. It was a fraud. It was a crime. They promised you liberty. Where is liberty? They promised you prosperity. Where is prosperity? They promised you elevation. Where is the elevation? Where is the moral good that the war has given the world? Where is the respect for human life? Where are the respect and admiration for the good characteristics and the good of human nature? Never before the war, as now, have there been so many crimes, so much corruption, so much degeneration as there is now.
God, I must have killed a million men. Now they want me back.
again. I ain't marching anymore. Why are the ones who lead us to the war never the ones to fall? Take a look at what we've won with the saber and the gun, and tell me, is it worth it all? I flew my final mission over Japanese skies, set off that mighty mushroom roar. When I saw those cities burning, I knew that I was learning. Marching anymore, and now some union leader screams because they close a missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it love or call it reason, call it peace or call it treason, but I ain't marching anymore. Why are the ones who lead us to the war the saber and the gun, and tell me, is it worth it all? Tell me, is it worth it all? I ain't marching anymore.
So the songs in that selection were Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?, Out of Your Pocket, Banks of Marble, and Phil Oakes' I Ain't Marching Anymore, of course, sung by Charlie King.
So I'm now getting my photo taken by Keith McHenry, who has announced this smallest of all protests. And he is here with his own sign, which he has foisted upon other people. Now, what does this mean, Keith?
This is a poster that I'm having for the traffic to read, and we are getting thumbs up for it.
I did hear one honk. Excuse me, madam, what are you doing here?
Saying my peace.
It says no nukes, peace now. Like, what exactly do you mean by that?
No nukes, peace now.
Can you clarify that?
I don't want to be able to glow in the dark. Or have anybody else glow in the dark.
So you're worried about the threat of nuclear war?
I am very afraid of that.
Well, don't you trust our President Biden?
No, no.
Well, what about President Putin? Certainly he wouldn't risk a nuclear war.
No, no.
You don't trust either President Putin or President...
I don't trust any politicians.
Well, don't you think that's a little paranoid? If you can't trust Putin and Biden, who can you trust?
Can't trust politicians, that's for sure.
My goodness, no. I don't know what to tell you, except a little therapy, perhaps?
Stop the war, stop the threat of nuclear holocaust.
What kind of reception are you getting?
A few peace signs, a few thumbs up. Mostly they're trying to ignore.
Well, that's, I think, the... After all, you must ignore what you cannot change, right?
It's the Santa Cruz way. Party, party.
You hear that?
Spend money.
Yeah, is this your first peace protest this year?
Maybe.
Well, here comes a police officer. Would you like to address this particular individual?
No. They have guns, too.
And since we're kind of reviewing peripherally an anti-war protest... And thinking about another one on Sunday, here's an article from Counterpunch. Russian takeover of Chernobyl poses grave health threat, which struck me as interesting information and chilling information, actually. It's by Carl Grossman, Christy Binkley, and Joseph Mangano, none of whom are really familiar names to me, but I'm going to read some of this. The takeover of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant site by Russian military forces poses a threat to safety and health unprecedented in the atomic era. For the first time, a war is being fought in a nation with nuclear power reactors. Ukraine is home to the Chernobyl reactor number 4, which underwent a disastrous meltdown in 1986. Although the plant is no longer operating, a massive amount of radioactive waste is contained in a concrete building called the New Safe Confinement, subsequently built over it. Chernobyl's reactors 1 to 3 remain operational until they were shut down in the 1990s, so they remained operational, but still store enormous amounts of waste, consisting mostly of cesium or cesium-137, strontium-90, and plutonium-239. The waste will remain radioactive for thousands of years. The environment for miles surrounding the Chernobyl site is still highly contaminated from the meltdown's releases. Since Russian troops took it over, spikes in airborne radioactive levels are being reported. The increase in radiation, according to Reuters, has been attributed to, quote, military activity causing radioactive dust to rise into the air. Aside from Chernobyl, there are 15 nuclear power reactors at 4 plants still operating in Ukraine. Zaporizhzhia is home to 6 of the reactors, making it the largest nuclear plant in Europe and one of the 10 largest in the world. It is located in eastern Ukraine, the area closest to the border with Russia. Each reactor at Chernobyl and elsewhere in Ukraine contains enormous amounts of radioactive high-level nuclear waste. A loss of cooling water could cause massive discharge of radioactivity into the air, water, and food supply. Large-scale meltdowns at nuclear plants have occurred at Chernobyl and more recently in 2011 at Fukushima, Japan. The health consequences have been tragic. Over 100 radioactive chemicals only created in nuclear weapons explosions and nuclear reactor operations were unleashed into the environment. Each of these radioactive chemicals increased the risk of cancer and other diseases. The fetus, infants, and young child are especially vulnerable. In 2009, the New York Academy of Sciences published a book, Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and the Environment. A team of European scientists led by Dr. Alexei Yablokov, former environmental advisor to Russia's presidents Boris Yeltsin and Mikhail Gorbachev, assembled over 5,000 research studies, mostly written in Russia and not previously published. The results were staggering. Yablokov's team estimated that just in the first 20 years after the Chernobyl meltdown, some 986,000 deaths attributable to it occurred, many in parts of Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. The percent of children living in these areas considered in good health plunged from 80% to 20%. Rates of certain cancers soared, including childhood thyroid cancer in Ukraine, 20 times higher, and Belarus, 200 times higher. Rates of disease in covering many organs in the body all increased in areas closest to Chernobyl. Yablokov's team indicated that the number of casualties would continue to grow well after the publication of the book. The meltdowns at Chernobyl and Fukushima were accidents. The Chernobyl disaster occurred due to human error. The Fukushima catastrophe resulted from severe weather conditions. These events were in facilities manned by scientists who desperately tried to stop the spread of radioactivity. The current situation is different. The takeover of Chernobyl by hostile military forces shifts the chain of command in reactor management away from scientists whose constant presence is required. CNN reports that Russian soldiers are holding the Chernobyl staff hostage. Moreover, Chernobyl, the Chernobyl site is now a war zone. Russian troops moved into the Chernobyl site because it represents the shortest route from Russia to Ukraine's capital, Kiev, from the north. What would be the result of an exchange of fire at Chernobyl? The puncturing of the containment over Reactor 4 alone could release significant amounts of radioactivity, as would any breach of water-cooled waste storage at Reactors 1 through 3. Leaders must make all deliberate efforts towards a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine, which would include an end to military control of Chernobyl and other nuclear power plants in the country so dangerous radioactivity can be secured. Avoidance of another massive release of these toxic chemicals is the highest priority, not just for Ukraine, but for Europe and the world, and must be avoided at all costs. Of course, there's always the nuclear war opportunity or risk, which is even worse. And Carl Grossman and Christy Brinkley are board members of the New York-based Radiation and Public Health Project Research Group. and Joseph Mangano is executive director of that group. And the story, again, is Russian takeover of Chernobyl poses grave health threat. A lot of the media that I've been reading has been focused on military advances, justifications for the war, either from the side of Russia or the side of the Ukraine, the fate, the question of whether the folks in eastern Ukraine are being repressed by the Kiev government, and whether they, when in appealing to Russia, they were doing so, whether it was a legitimate appeal or whether it was some sort of false flag operation, some kind of phony attempt to get Russia, that Russia actually manipulated itself. But I'm interested in resolving these issues, and I don't know, I'm still working on this. But an issue that, again, has come up recently for me, which kind of comes out in that article that I just read, is the issue of the nuclear reactors. Here's another story about that. 15 nuclear reactors in the midst of battle by Robert Hunziker. This is the February 28th edition of the Counterpunch website. Russian forces have captured Chernobyl, a 1,000-square-mile radioactive exclusion zone. But more significantly, what about Ukraine's nuclear reactors smack dab in the midst of a theater of war? A complicating, dangerous aspect of Russia's invasion is the status of Chernobyl's sister reactors, 15 reactors at four nuclear power plants exposed in a war zone of bombing, missile attacks, and rampant gunfire, or perhaps a breakdown of crucial infrastructure that keeps super-hot atom-splitting vessel containers and spent fuel rods in open pools of water, cool enough to prevent a massive zirconium fryer or hydrogen explosion that spews radioactivity over the countryside. With an odd twist of bad is good for the enemy, Ukraine's rickety Russian-designed nuclear power plants serve as a defense mechanism for Putin's armed forces, essentially prohibiting any involvement by NATO forces that must know that the worst possible tactic would be to escalate warfare in Ukraine with 15 vulnerable nuclear reactors in the line of fire. 50% of the country's electricity generation comes from nuclear. Of heightened concern, some of the 15 operating old Soviet model nuclear reactors are deemed to be so rickety that they would not be allowed to operate in the EU today, that's the European Union, for safety reasons. All of Ukraine's nuclear power units were designed in the Soviet Union, comprising 13 VVER-1000 type reactors and two VVER-440 units. None of the units currently meet modern international safety standards. 12 of the 15 units have already exceeded their designated lifetime of 30 years. Following the Fukushima disaster, stress tests were carried out on all European nuclear power plants, including Ukraine. The aim of the assessments was to check whether the safety standards used when specific power plants received their licenses were sufficient to cover unexpected extreme events. Specifically, the test measured the ability of nuclear facilities to withstand damage from hazards such as earthquakes, flooding, terrorist attacks, or aircraft collisions. As a result of deficiencies with Ukraine's nuclear power plants, the Ukraine government approved a complex consolidated safety upgrade program with an initial deadline of 2017, funded by a €600 million loan. Because of several postponements, the deadline was shifted to 2023. Therefore, and forebodingly, the existing nuclear power plants are not completely safe, as some safety measures are still not implemented. Nuclear reactors require a constant supply of electricity and water to operate. As such, infrastructure away from the plants is crucial for ongoing operations. Fukushima has already shown what can happen when infrastructure support for a nuclear plant goes bad. Ukraine's 15 operating reactors depend upon the electric grid to help keep things cool in the event of an abrupt shutdown. Additionally, some of the deficiencies found at Ukraine's reactors had to do with weaknesses exposed by backup generators and electrical control systems. Misfires or stray artillery or misguided missiles are the main risks. As, for example, A thermal power station at Shakastya caught fire only recently amid shelling, leaving 40,000 Ukrainians without electricity. In the case of destruction of a nuclear power plant, according to Dmytro Gumniak, the Kiev nuclear safety expert, I think the consequences will be so much worse than at Fukushima and Chernobyl together. If speaking about consequences of this war situation, Europe will be totally contaminated. An additional risk is the Chernobyl decommissioning site with 22,000 assemblies of spent nuclear fuel stored in special casks. These are not designed for protection from military firepower. In the case of the destruction of these casks, radioactive materials could be released and transferred to Ukraine and other European territories. This is a very dangerous situation. According to the Nuclear Index, the Nuclear Security Index for 2020, under the category Risk Environment, which calculates political stability, effective governance, pervasiveness of corruption, and illicit activities by non-state actors, Ukraine scores a subpar, lowly 14 out of 100, and that was before this war. Yet, there's even more. A radioactive time bomb is already ticking away at the Uni Kamyar Yomkon mine in occupied Donetsk, a Russian breakaway foe state, which has been slowly contaminating the environment for some time, but could become a freakish radioactive monster. This stems from a deep underground nuclear test conducted by the USSR in 1979. The nuke explosion melted the walls into glass, creating the Klivakh facility, which is a vitrified capsule of radioactivity. It requires constant pumping of water out of the shaft to prevent flooding. Prior to Russian occupation, the Ukrainian government spent millions pumping water. But when the Donetsk People's Republic took over in 2018, pumping operations ceased and the infrastructure was sold for scrap metal. According to a 2021 report by Truthhounds, Ukraine-based human rights NGO, at the Yonkom mine, there is a risk of the glass capsule being destroyed and the leaking of highly hazardous radioactive elements into surface waters. Just 2 months after water pumping ceased, the level of mine water in the shaft of the mine increased by 157 meters. Now the capsule is believed to have flooded, and according to the international human rights community, the concentration of radionuclides in the aquifers 5 kilometers away from the site register 20 to 34 becquerel per kilogram. Accordingly, low-level radioactive waters are already entering drinking water sources. A bigger risk yet is the Yomkon mine radioactive cocktail spreading far beyond the Ukrainian borders should it seep into the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea on to the Mediterranean Sea. It should be noted that Russian-backed separatists deny any changes in radiation levels and also deny inordinate risks at the Yomkon mine site. However, it should also be noted that the Russian separatists have denied an International Atomic Energy Agency request to access the site for evaluation purposes. Meanwhile, Sergei Kistostakia, Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations, my apologies for my mispronouncing your name, Sergei, has called upon the UN to carry out an environmental impact in Donetsk and Luhansk. In the final analysis, the Ukrainian-Russian imbroglio is like falling into a surreal state down the rabbit hole, not knowing what peril is right around the corner or when it'll strike, but knowing it lurks in the shadows with enormously devastating impact. So it looks like we're going to be cutting this particular edition short. Time problems. I don't want to get this out sort of on time. But actually, even as we speak, if you're listening to this in its usual time on March 3rd, you'll be, well, likely missing the Planning Commission hearing, which is considering the appeal of the OVO ordinance. And that will already probably be a fait accompli. You can try to tune into it by zooming in, but you're more likely to be successful if you go to, if you're looking for events that are happening this weekend. Saturday the 5th, there's going to be a gathering at the homeless union area where the union used to gather every Friday for its meetings at the right above the benchlands, between the benchlands and the county building, in order to decide on a strategy and how to address what appears to be an anti-homeless rally at the Paradox Hotel by a neighborhood organization that is meeting from 10 to noon on Saturday. Then on Sunday, as mentioned before, there is a peace rally at the town clock starting at 1, kind of at the same time as the Food Not Bombs meal. I'll hopefully be covering some of those events, getting to some of them, yes, I hope to. So now, as a kind of a sort of mini flashback, we're going to be going back to May 3rd, 1996, an interview with Santa Barbara outspoken activist Bob Hansen, or Beaming Bob, as I used to call him when I was down there. He gives a bit of the history of the Santa Barbara struggle against its sleeping ban, and talks about, well, variety of the different tactics that he used, and the subsequent history. The Santa Barbara's heyday was in the 80s, but they were still fighting for rights in 96, and they're still engaged in that struggle. This not so much through activists on the streets, which is too bad, but through the occasional potential lawsuits of attorneys. Who you actually heard some of that recently on free radios, on this show recently. But unfortunately, not a lot is happening. Anyway, maybe we can learn something from the past, get a little inspiration from that, a little education from that. But in any case, here it comes.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
How you doing?
All right.
Santa Barbara.
Bob Hansen from Santa Barbara. I'm glad you got through. Were you having trouble getting through before?
Yeah, I tried about 10 o'clock, a little after 10, and I kept getting busy.
Ah.
You guys are really busy up there.
We were very busy, and actually we had the, I think it was either the phone off the hook or the ringer was screwed up. I appreciate your trying again. Unfortunately, the people you were going to talk to, the guy is taken off, but maybe we can still talk to you. Maybe some people are listening to you on the radio. Bob, you're what, longtime homeless activist in Santa Barbara. You struggled to humanize the sleeping ban down there in 1986. You're a carpenter. You're a public speaker. You've run for mayor many times. You've been arrested many, many times. In fact, you're known as Protest Bob.
Right.
And you actually were part of a caravan across the country in 1988. What was that march called? What was it all about?
It was the homeless and poor people's peace march to Washington, D.C., just to bring awareness that they're not talking about that issue during the presidential race. So we were trying to keep the issue alive. And so we walked about 15 miles a day, started in Santa Barbara on Martin Luther King's birthday, January 15th, and arrived just the day before the election in Washington, D.C.
And do you think that had much impact? Were you hassled as you went across the country? Were there arrests for illegal sleeping and things of that sort?
No, they treated us with kid gloves. I think that the people that saw us saw that we were, doing something, which I think they appreciated. We always had money in our kitty. People came forward and helped us out all the way along. We picked up aluminum cans. I think it was worth it. It kept the issue alive, and I think people saw that we wanted to do something for the people that, without homes in America.
How many of you were there on this caravan?
Well, there was roughly about 15 of us all the way across. Some people would come and go and this and that. And,
men, women, and children?
Yeah, there was about three or four children off and on, and there was about three ladies off and on. And then there were some older people that were up in their 60s and younger people down in their 20s. And so, most of the people were semi-young, under 30. And we had our, disagreements and stuff, but it was a successful walk. And
you literally walked across the country?
Right. It took us about 9.5 months.
Wow. And you called this march?
The Homeless and Poor People's Peace March to Washington, D.C.
And indeed, it was. This was 2 years after the Come to the Fig Tree, Go to Sleep, Go to Jail campaign resulted in an end, at least in some areas, to the city's sleeping ban in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, somewhat, but still they... As soon as the meeting was over, they started creeping back on to erase some of the stuff. And even just yesterday, a friend and myself, Cobblestone Colin and myself, talked to Sandra Lasager, who is the city administrator who runs the city. And she said, no, you can't sleep on this improve property. We go, well, isn't that the intention? I just talked to the mayor 2 weeks ago, and she said you can have your bedroll in which you can feasibly carry with yourself and sleep on unimproved city property. So she denied it, and then about 5 minutes into the conversation, she said, well, if it's not posted, you know, so if it's posted, you can't, which would be, you know, fire hazard or closed from 10 at night until 6 in the morning.
You know, actually, what you're talking about now is the current situation in Santa Barbara. And what I was referring to is the situation in 1986 when, in fact, for 3 years, as I understand it, from 86 to 89, with the exception of the parks and the beaches, it was legal to sleep on public property, whether developed or undeveloped, in Santa Barbara when they ended that sleeping provision of the sleeping ban. Is that accurate?
Yeah, but still, they immediately started putting signs up in a lot of the public places, like around City Hall or buildings down by the beach. And so, just like even this, you know, talking about unimproved city property, they posted. So, as we talked to her yesterday, we were saying, hey, you can feasibly have your bedroll in which you can carry with you. She goes, yes, that's, you know, so it's not considered camping. So they're trying to define camping.
That is, in fact, Bob, what we're trying to do here in Santa Cruz is get the law changed so that the act of sleeping itself is not illegal, the act of covering up with blankets is not illegal, and carrying, you know, your possessions with you in a blanket and a sleeping bag is not evidence of, quote, camping. But we can't get the mayor to even look at this, Mayor Mike Rodkin, because he says that if the law were changed, everybody and his mother would come to Santa Cruz. Now, did that happen in Santa Barbara when the law changed in 1986?
No. The same people, basically. People will drift in during the wintertime a little bit, but, you know, there was hardly any influx. If anything, they have gotten tougher just by, you know, having bicycle cops and getting you for throwing a cigarette butt down or just, you know, so they've gotten crazier, while really the influx of people really hasn't changed. They are so afraid that they're, you know, that something's going to happen, that people can sleep, or people are going to gather, or people are going to come, or whatever, but they at least have to have the right to sleep. I mean, they can get you quotes for panhandling if they want. They can get you for doing open containers or whatever, but at night when the sun goes down and everyone else is sleeping in the world, that's, you know, that's the right of everyone to go to sleep.
Indeed, you would think that it's an unreasonable regulation of, even if you claim that, you know, that you can regulate hours of panhandling or places of panhandling. For example, in Santa Cruz, it's illegal to peacefully ask for money after dark anywhere in the city. Although that law, as I have not yet heard of that specific provision being enforced, but it is on the books thanks to the Liberal City Council and its 1994 vote. Yet sleeping, one line of attack that's been suggested is that in Santa Cruz particularly, and I guess in Santa Barbara too, it's criminal to sleep in the nighttime hours. Because in 1989, even though you had written your city council at the after a mass protest threat by Mitch Snyder and a great, you know, a massive organizing by yourself and the Creative Community for Nonviolence and the Legal Defense Center and Will Hastings down there, and endless testimony from social service providers at city council meetings, great financial donations from Kit Tremaine, academic support from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and Rob Rosenthal and others, writers like Peter Marin, support from media and national media, which was located at the Reagan White House at that time, and also support from Hollywood figures. You had some famous Hollywood people like Martin Sheen and Cher and so forth, who were actually showing up at your sleepouts.
Right.
You had all this going. There was a change in the sleeping law. For 3 years, it was legal to sleep on at least some public property in some areas. And then in 1989, a reactionary judge ruled that no, camping as a matter of definition includes the word sleeping, and therefore any form of sleeping is now a form of camping. And you then started a second sleepout at City Hall in 1990, perhaps similar to the 65-day-long sleepout we have here currently going on in Santa Cruz. What happened with that sleepout, Bob?
Well, it started out, you know, well-organized and with good intentions. But then after a while, people start, you know, wearing down, and kind of it gets a little disorganized. Kind of at the very end of the sleepout, there weren't that many people, and then some of the more rowdy, aggressive people on the street kind of, you know, were in the sleeping area there and kind of taking, bullying their ideas around. So it was quite difficult at the very end, but in the beginning, for the first couple of months, it had a good spirit and all. At the end, it, you know, kind of petered out. But all in all, you know, even the media kind of, you know, said, hey, it's a bunch of bums out here at City Hall. But all we were asking, hey, where can we sleep? Can we sleep? You know, it was a simple question. You know, it's like, And
now you were part of that sleep out yourself, right?
Right.
Were you there almost every night, or what was your situation?
I was probably there 75% of the time.
And did you receive tickets, and were you subject to arrest because of your actions there?
No, because they basically we could sleep there somewhat. They kind of let us do the demonstration because City Hall is a place where you can't come with grievances, so they kind of accepted that. But
so
there were a few people that, you know, they started putting signs up, and they got them for putting their foot on the City Hall steps and things like that.
Well, I understand there was a specific, because of the, there was a specific law that said what the camp. At City Hall.
Right.
So they criminalized your demonstration out of existence eventually.
Right.
And also I understand there were some divisions in the homeless movement itself. Some people, you were offered a change in the sleeping ban by some city council members, but others wanted more radical measures?
Yeah. So, you know, there's always that. You know, even when you go to a meeting, you know, you got to sit there and agree on things. So there were divisions at times. And even myself, I wouldn't mind just having, you know, almost like the armory, you know, year-round. At a certain time at night, the armory's open, or a sleeping area during the summer, and then at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, it's closed. You know, at least that. It would be nice to have a place 24 hours a day, especially when you have people on our streets that have some difficulties in their lives, mental or alcohol addiction or older, but at least have a place, some places designated that everyone can live with. Some of the places that they've designated here are in the neighborhoods, and that's not going to fly. So, you know, there's some buildings, some parking lots, or even the armory could be open during the summertime so that especially people that are homeless or without homes that have real difficulties in their lives could have a place to sleep. And we mentioned that to the city administrator yesterday, and she says, well, they can go to the rescue mission. They go to Sally. Well, they're not accepted there somewhat, some of the people. They don't feel comfortable there.
You're talking about the Salvation Army and the Salvation Army and the rescue mission.
Yeah, they kind of push the religious, you know, tones down people, and some people just don't feel comfortable with it. And they're fearful too. They just want a place just to not have people, you know, jumping on them. And,
well, you also have 80,000 people in Santa Barbara. It's about almost twice the size of Santa Cruz, or, you know, something like that. And Santa Cruz in the city, I estimate 500 to 1,500 homeless. You must have, 3,000 homeless people. Well, what are your estimates of the number of homeless in Santa Barbara?
It's probably up there. You know, a lot of people, you know, if you get on the streets or go around and start talking to people, there's a lot of people that don't, you know, aren't visible. You know, so they're, you know, they're either sleeping in the cars or sleeping in other parts of the city. So the real visible ones downtown, you know, just to tip the iceberg up. Really, the people that can't afford and, you know, can't make it with the small checks they get or their jobs that they work for $6 an hour. So, but they want to live here and they want to be productive, and so, but they're still without a home.
You also have a much larger Hispanic population,
yes.
And the Hispanic homeless make up a significant segment too.
About half, I would think. So it's even probably more than the 3,000 you mentioned. You know, if you really look at it, you know, in a kind of a way of saying, hey, are they sleeping on people's, you know, sofas or the carpet in the front room or in the car in the backyard or something like that. So there's probably 5,000, 6,000, you know, people without, quotes, homes, you know, in this community, easy.